This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour today. We have quite an assembly of news stories to cover, and our panel of trumpet writers are anxious to bring you up to speed on all of them. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
And joining us via Skype from our office in the UK, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also in the UK, we have Kieran Underwood.
Hello.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
Well, at the Philadelphia Trumpet, we really try to keep an eye on the whole planet. We watch and try to bring you the news from the four corners of the world. But if there's one nation that we watch with extra focus and scrutiny, it would have to be Israel. We expect the situation in Israel to really become kind of a trigger for so many of the other events that we're expecting to happen. So we keep a particularly close eye on Israel, on its domestic politics, on its neighbors' actions toward it, on the way countries like Germany and America treat it, and of course on the Israel-Palestine divide. And this week, a pretty significant development happened regarding those last couple of points there, at least very potentially significant, I think. And for this one, we'll go to our man right there in Jerusalem, Israel, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so there appeared a very interesting story in the Jerusalem Post just today, and it was entitled, Abbas Has Decided to Sign a Peace Deal with Israel. Of course, Abbas represents the Palestinian, the PLO, Palestinian Authority. And this would mark this would be the first time that's ever happened that a Palestinian leader has agreed to sign a peace deal with Israel. So this is obviously just hearsay at the moment, but it is very interesting in light of some of the facts or some of the opinions that's brought out in this piece, as well as just going back to or in reference to the meeting that Mr. Abbas had 2 weeks ago with President Donald Trump. He, of course, is coming over to Israel on May 22nd, so just a couple of weeks away or just under 2 weeks. And Israel is very concerned that he is going to push them towards a peace deal with the Palestinians. Now, what's interesting in this article, of course, we've already talked about that he's interested in the peace deal. It shows that Mahmoud Abbas is ready to make some conditions or some concessions, before they even get to the table, which is something that he hasn't been willing to do before. Mm-hmm. And this, for example, he said he's going to renew talks without preconditions. In the past, he said, I'm going to come to the table and talk when they have a settlement freeze, when Israel decides that they're not going to build any more settlements or houses inside the West Bank. He's dropped that completely. And he's also sent some of his advisors to declare that the Palestinians are ready to negotiate certain land swaps with Israel. This means that some territories in the West Bank, in order for a two-state solution to work, would actually go to Israel instead of the Palestinian state. But then some territories that would have been in the Israel pre-1949, they would go to the Palestinians. So these look to be some concessions that might put peace negotiations or might make peace negotiations something that is legitimate and something that might actually move forward over here in the next couple of months.
So let's say that Mr. Abbas is sincere and that he's suddenly, you know, very reasonable and flexible and ready and willing to negotiate with Netanyahu and the Israelis. Do you think that he would have the backing of the Palestinian people?
Well, it is interesting. I mean, I would say there's probably, I don't know if it was half, if it'd be half the Palestinian people, but there have been numerous polls that have taken that half the Palestinians would be ready to make peace with Israel, just the general population. There's a strong current from the leadership that isn't willing to make peace with Israel. Now, I do want to just draw attention to the fact that this hasn't been words out of his mouth just yet. These type of comments actually came to the press via the meeting that happened with Mr. Trump through some close advisors of Mr. Trump that kind of leaked that he was willing to do to give these concessions straight off the bat. What had happened before Mr. Trump actually had the meeting with Abbas 2 weeks ago, Abbas actually went to meet with a very famous Jew, a Jew that leads the World Jewish Congress. He's one of the closest advisors to Trump, and he's the one that has encouraged Trump, even before he was president, to go after the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. He met with Abbas and basically said that, you know, I've got some ways. If you say a couple of these things, you're probably going to win over the president. So you actually have a Jew that is behind this peace push that's actually working with Abbas to try and get him or get him to say the right thing so that Mr. Trump will jump on board. And this past week, Mr. Netanyahu was absolutely furious that he had somebody in the Jewish lobby in Washington actually encouraging these peace to push peace negotiations forward, because it is a complete non-starter. If you see through the veneer of these apparent concessions that Abbas is about to make, Israel believes that peace at this moment is virtually impossible.
Why is that? Why is there such skepticism on Mr. Netanyahu's part there?
Well, there's a host of reasons, but I think Melanie Phillips, she wrote yesterday in the Jerusalem Post, put it most succinctly. She said that the only concession that matters, even though, you know, Abbas is going to come to the table without any preconditions, she says the only concession that really matters, though, is the abandonment of the Palestinian goal to destroy Israel. Mm-hmm. That's the one that he hasn't agreed to yet, and that he won't agree to, because that is the Palestinian goal. That's the goal of Hamas. It's been the goal of the PLO for the past 30 years. Just do it slowly. Just do it by piecemeal. Grab a bit of Israel here, a bit of Israel there, and gradually our end goal is not to live side by side with the Israelis. They've never, ever, ever, ever stated that they want to live side by side with the Israelis. They said they'll want a peace deal, but that's just moving towards their ultimate goal of the eradication of the Jewish state. Nevertheless, this is important, because in 2 weeks' time, he's going to be here. And we have, as Carolyn Glick said this week, the most pro-Israel president in history on a collision course with Israel. Trump is that. He's pro-Israel. But as he pushes this deal hard, and as he realizes that the Palestinians are the ones that aren't willing to give too many concessions, that is going to put him on a collision course with his ally in the Middle East. And that's something we expect at the trumpet to actually take place, is a divergent United States, a growing separation between the United States and Israel going forward.
And now you can see how, even under a president that is so remarkably pro-Israel, like Donald Trump, how that could happen. So that's really interesting. We'll be looking forward to hearing your assessment in a couple of weeks about what to make of that trip after it happens. Well, a few days ago on May 7th, the people of France elected Emmanuel Macron to be their next president. He's the youngest leader of France since Napoleon Bonaparte, and he's now one of only two people on the planet who is under 40 years old and in command of a nuclear arsenal, the other being Kim Jong-un. But before this vote was held, we've speculated quite a lot on the Trumpet Hour just about how this election might turn out and what its implications would be for France, for Germany, and for all of Europe. And now it has happened. And so to give us a read on the outcome, we'll go to our man just across the channel from France, Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so it was really a landslide election for Emmanuel Macron there. He won about two-thirds of the vote, very soundly defeating the National Front and Marine Le Pen, which was, I think, in line with just about everything everyone has suspected. To give credit where credit's due, the pollsters seem to be just about right, finally, this time around.
Did they predict within the percentage points that happened the way it would happen as well?
I'm not sure. I think they put very large error bars, I think, on their forecasts this time.
Yeah, that seems like the safe way to go.
I mean, I think one of the things that made it so uncertain, though, and why there were such large error bars, was that there was a lot of apathy this time around. And you did see that in the vote. I think it was a record number of spoiled ballots. where people just deliberately filled in the ballots wrong, or often they wrote in something or wrote something on the ballots. I think it was about 10 million of the ballots were spoiled, which is a huge amount for people to actually bother to show up and vote and then spoil the ballot. There were also a very high, I don't think it was quite a record level, but it was definitely one of the top few kind of highest or lowest ever turnouts. And one of the chants ahead of time was neither Macron nor Le Pen, and even some people were one of the buzzwords was neither plague nor cholera. So just, I mean, there's a lot about this election that shows that France's politics are in crisis, which is why it was all so uncertain. I think the other thing that's really important to think about with this election is that neither of France's two main candidates made it through to the final round, which it would be almost as if having a president, like if Nick's presidential election, neither the Republicans nor the Democrats were the front runners. It's a huge change. You know, Macron leads a party that he only started just over a year ago. I mean, Melanie Phillips put it well when she was on this show a week and a half ago, I think it was, talking about how, you know, he is an establishment figure. He served under François Hollande, but he's tried to wrap himself in this anti-establishment cloak because the establishment and the way politics is done is just so virulently unpopular. Then you've got the National Front, which for decades has been considered beyond the pale, and they outperformed the main right-wing party. And right. I thought the Daily Signal, they had an article earlier this week that just really put it very well. You know, this is a party where you've got, even after their kind of denazification, if you like, under Marine Le Pen, they still, one of their recent leaders denied that Zyklon gas was used during the Holocaust and have worked hard to try to minimize and even cover up the history of World War II and France and the French political establishment's involvement in sending Jews to Auschwitz and this kind of thing. Mm. So a deeply unsavory party, a party that isn't in any way conservative and is much more, you know, nationalist, socialist. It's and much more right wing. And for them to have done that well as well, and even to have come as far as getting 1/3 of the vote compared to about 15% of the vote last time they made it through to the final round, it shows some big problems with French politics.
So a lot of people are saying that the fact that Le Pen and the National Front lost, this was a big blow to populism, and of course it came on the heels of other right wing nationalist movements in Europe faltering in Austria and the Netherlands and other places recently. But you're saying that this doesn't mean that populism and nationalism are dead in Europe?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is part of a story that's just going to keep going and going. Even ahead of the election, Marine Le Pen was saying, we're not focusing on this election. We're focusing on 2022 or whenever the next time around. That's there. That this just keeps building, that each time they vote in a different, you know, he may be from a different party, they get the same result. It doesn't work. It sends more and more votes to the far right. But I think the really important thing to watch now in France is they have parliamentary elections next month. Mm-hmm. And the president is winner takes all. Parliamentary is very different. And we saw Dutch politics completely fracture. And I don't think they've settled their coalition negotiations yet. And we're a month or two on from that. That kind of feels really like old news. This is where you start to see that fracturing really come into effect. And it seems like you get an unstable coalition government. That seems almost no way Macron can get a majority in parliament. So you would have, in some ways, even worse than a lame duck president, where you have a president from one party, a parliament or a legislature dominated by the other. Instead, it seems like you'll have a coalition and a president. And it is a recipe for just a very unstable government that can't get anything done. And you can see the rise of populism more. What might be even more interesting is if Macron does actually pull off a majority, because then if you look at what he's been saying, he's very pro-European with a lot of his policies. He basically says the current state of Europe is like being, he calls it, it's like being half pregnant. You know, it can't exist. Europe is halfway towards being a super state, and in this kind of half pregnant state, nothing works. It just can't function like that. And so he wants his vision that he's painted is very clearly a European superstate. He wants big transfers of money to the European Union, significant chunks of government money, a Eurozone treasury, Eurozone finance minister. And if he does get a majority in parliament, he wants to start making radical changes to the French economy and to really push there. So just looking at France right now and where do we go from this election, I mean, there's a number of different directions, but I think all the directions are very interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, just you're speaking about the unity of Europe that he was pushing for. I thought it was really significant that in addition to France's national anthem, he also chose the European anthem, Ode to Joy by Beethoven, to be played at his victory campaign there. What's your take on the allegations of Russian hacking against Macron? Do you think there's much to that?
I think in these days of there's so many agendas going around, it's always hard to say. I think it does look, from what I've seen, it does look very likely that they did try to influence the election. I think it did look like, because the French voting laws, there's a period of time before the election where the campaigns aren't allowed to say anything. And the way that the news was kind of timed to come out right before that kicked in, to me, it seemed like somebody who didn't have very much, but wanted to kind of have, it seemed like if there was something really substantial, Russia would have released it 2-3 weeks ahead of the election. Or held on to it and used it as blackmail material. Mm. By releasing it at such a short period of time ahead of time, it looked like a fairly, an attempt to just kind of short-term influence the election. I think what I did find quite disquieting was the way all the mainstream media simply refused to talk about it, which, I understand where they're coming from. We don't want to let Russia sway this election. We think Russia is behind it. But I think that's a very dangerous trend that we're seeing more and more of, where the media are also kind of trying to act as this elitist gatekeeper of knowledge and saying, well, actually, we don't think you should know this. I think if it's in the public domain, regardless of how it got there, mainstream media should be reporting on it. And if they're not, it just pushes people, I think, to all these questionable sites, which actually were making a lot of things up and led to a bit of a mess. So I don't think they handled it particularly well.
Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Richard. On Wednesday's episode of Trumpet Hour, Mr. Joel Hilliker interviewed a Russian author named Eugene Yelchin about his experiences growing up in the Soviet Union. It's a fascinating and very enlightening interview, so I hope you'll give that a listen if you've not yet heard it. And one of the points that Mr. Yelchin makes in the interview is just about how hard it was during the Soviet era for the people to learn about their true history. He talks about people secretly typing up books by hand and then lending them to each other for just one night at a time and risking, arrest and possible imprisonment just for having those books. And they did all of that just so they could try to learn their true history, the history that was not state sanctioned, and so that they could learn what was happening in that totalitarian system. Well, the Soviet system, of course, has collapsed, but the Russian government is still interfering with the way history is taught to Russian students. There was actually a new set of textbooks introduced this year that has a lot of analysts very worried about revisionism. And to tell us about this, we'll go to Kieran Underwood.
Yeah, on May 9, Russia has a holiday, and it's called Victory Day. And this is one of their favorite national holidays. And so all the Russian students, they come out, they celebrate. They talk about that history, and this Victory Day is the Russian or the Soviet Union's victory over the Nazis. But on this day or the day before, the Moscow Times put out this piece called How Russian Kids Are Taught World War II. And they were talking about these three new textbooks, which are sanctioned by the government, and the teachers who are complaining about them, and how Russian history teachers are finding themselves under pressure to conform to the Kremlin's interpretation of the war. So one of the things that they bring out here is the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939. I've got a quote here saying that there is no word aggression in the text, this one textbook, one of the three. And a quote from the textbook talking about after the Russians moved in after the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact had been signed. They moved into eastern Russia, and it says on September 17th, 1939, part of the Red Army was given orders to cross the western border and liberate western Ukraine and western Belarus. So what is happening is they're calling a liberation what was actually pretty much the Nazis splitting up, the Nazis in the Soviet Union just splitting up Eastern Europe, and then the Soviet Union just walking in and pretty much taking the land from Poland. But apparently this is a liberation according to the new textbooks.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, any objective bystander can look back on the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and say that was an egregious agreement for the Soviets to enter into with the Nazis, and it resulted in so much destruction for those Eastern European states. But now they're whitewashing it and basically just saying, you know, we were trying to, you know, it was strictly defensive for us.
It was just a defensive pact.
They're liberating Poland from the Poles.
Right. Yeah. Sort of like the way the Japanese now often revise their textbooks to say that when they invaded China, they were liberating China from the Allied powers and Chinese forces there, and all sorts of things that are just don't at all conform to what actually happened.
Right. Yeah. Also, this year, a man in a city, it's called Perm, he was fined $3,500 or 200,000 rubles for reposting an article which correctly stated that the Soviet Union invaded Poland in 1939. So just for saying that, reposting this article, he was fined $3,500.
Hmm. Yeah, that's part of the new campaign that Mr. Putin launched in 2015, I guess, where he is just really cracking down on all sorts of domestic media, including social media users. Even if you just have a Twitter account that makes statements like that, then you are subject to fines and possibly even imprisonment.
So the textbook also gives a similar explanation for Russia's military presence in the Baltic states. So according to some of the authors of these other textbooks, the other two of the three, Russia's invasion and annexation of the three northern European countries was the result of democratic parliament elections in the countries. And this one commentator of the textbook says, well, really, it doesn't say anything about the fact that those Baltic states had no choice about whether they accepted these Soviet democratic parliamentary elections. I mean, they're pretty much just turning something into what was forced into, oh, it's democratic, it's an election. We just didn't take them over.
Right.
It was democratic.
So what do you think the purpose of all this whitewashing is?
Well, later on in the article, one of the teachers is talking about them trying to have a specific and unified view of the war, of World War II. But what this one teacher says is they're trying to do this through this propaganda, but really a lot of the Russians don't even believe it. You have some who are going along with it, but even on Victory Day, that May 9th, you had people who really could see through it because they've had that small chance, you know, between the end of the Soviet Union and now, where they've had the chance to see some of the real history, even if they're trying to go back to that Stalinist era now.
Andrew.
Right, yeah, because if you can, if they're successful in starting to convince some of these people that the invasion of Poland or the invasion of the Baltic states was actually a liberation, that does make future invasions of countries easier, because that's just kind of struck me as it almost seems like the same tale you hear out of Russia about Crimea, where they had this referendum held after Russian troops were already all about with the guns, and then they make the case that, like, okay, well, Crimea it wasn't an invasion, it was a referendum. They willingly just chose to secede from their previous country and join Russia. And we really have no clue what the real referendum vote was, even. And now they're trying to make that same case that, like, oh, the invasion of Poland during the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is not much different than the invasion of Crimea, at least according to the Russian history books, which makes it that much easier to try to keep repeating that cycle over and over and over again.
Yes. Yeah, this kind of historic revisionism just does, it goes a long way to instill patriotism and nationalism and even jingoism in populations that should otherwise have some guilt and remorse about, you know, what their country's done in the past. So I think it does sow the seeds for strong future soldiers. Well, thanks very much for that, Kieran. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we're discussing today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they will be up there soon if they're not yet. So please stop into thetrumpet.com to get more information on these stories. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but first we'll cover one more story from a continent that we don't discuss quite as often as some others, and that is Africa. For this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Well, by some estimates, at least, the most dangerous profession in the world is actually farming, or specifically farming in South Africa. Hmm. There's been, for the past two, three decades, there's been a slew of farm murders. Hard to get concrete statistics, but we'll give you at least what you can put together here in a moment. This is something that really made international news headlines last February, when a British citizen was living with her husband on a farm in northern South Africa, when three black assailants broke into their house in the middle of the night, tied the couple up, slow roasted them with a blowtorch for several hours. Ooh. Before shoving plastic bags down their throats to try to suffocate them. The plastic bags didn't work, so they drove them to a roadside and I think shot the woman twice in the head and the man once in the neck. So the woman died in the hospital 2 days later with just like horrible burns all over her body from that blowtorch and several fractures in her skull. The man, Mr. Lynn, he is actually still alive and recovering from his wounds. And this, like I said, it made international news mainly because the woman was a British citizen, even though there's on average, from the statistics we know, one farm murder occurs every 5 days in South Africa. There's been, I guess, roughly 1,800 official farm murders since the end of apartheid in 1994. Mm-hmm. Not official from the South African police, but official from the AfriForum human rights group. Though, because the police forces are so corrupt there, a lot of people think the number may be two, even three times higher than that.
So what's behind this? What's the motivation for all these murders?
It's definitely a mixture of racism and greed. Mm-hmm. Now, there are, at least according to the AfriForum data, about two out of every three farm murders are white. So there are actually about a third of them are black, to where they just own land and someone wants your land, so they kill you for it. Mm-hmm. But especially amongst the white murders is where you're seeing this this just like brutal. It's not like they're shooting you in the head and taking it, but where you're torturing you with a power drill, roasting you with a blowtorch. And it is definitely widely believed that it's actually a targeted attack to try to drive white farmers off the land. Just recently, well, for a decade, even the president of South Africa has been notoriously for like singing militant hymns about shooting the Boer, which is a term for white farmers, or bring me my machine gun and shoot the farmers. So, and they've seen that whenever they sing these songs, these farm murders spike and they go up. And now more recently, he's been talking about amending South Africa's constitution to do like what they did in Zimbabwe in 2000 and just have the government come in and nationalize all white-owned land. Mm. But these farm attacks have almost been kind of a de facto way to nationalize these land.
Yeah.
Just that without the government actually doing it, the number of white farmers has decreased from 60,000 two decades ago to 30,000 today as, roughly 5% of them were just murdered. And then another 50% got out of Dodge.
So it's working then. It is succeeding in driving the white farmers out of the country, I guess.
Yeah, they've got rid of at least half of them, either just through fear or intimidation, and now the government's looking at making it official policy to just take the rest.
That is a terrifying story there, but we appreciate you bringing us up to speed on that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial, and the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about Germany's support for Lebanon, right-wing extremism in the German military, Japan aiming to amend its pacifist constitution, and we'll also talk about Puerto Rico's multi-billion dollar bankruptcy. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. These days, it's easy to label Lebanon as nothing more than an Iranian outpost. Iran's proxy, the terrorist group Hezbollah, has a stranglehold on Lebanon's government, so many of the world powers seem to have kind of written Lebanon off as just one of Iran's pawns. But there's one country that's going the opposite direction there. And to tell us about this development, we'll go once again to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so you have this really interesting situation that's developed over the past couple of years, or year and a half specifically, where Lebanon has fallen into the hands of Hezbollah control even more so. Although it is just really good to remember that over half of Lebanese, they resent the fact that the Iran has the controls over their government. And there's one man in particular that resents it more than most, and that's the prime minister of Lebanon. He's a Sunni Arab by virtue of their constitution, where they have to divide up between the sects the three most powerful positions in the government. A Sunni belongs to the prime ministership, and then a Shiite has to be the Speaker of the House, and then also a Christian has to be the president. So it's kind of like a power-sharing agreement. Mm-hmm. And ever since the president, who is a Christian, Michael Aoun, since he became president last year, he, even though he's a Christian, he's a Hezbollah ally. So you have this situation where most countries have pretty much given up on Lebanon. Even the Saudis last year said, you're not getting any more money. The Saudis have funded Lebanon to the tune of about, I forget, $70 billion over the past few years. So they're out. So you had Saad Hariri, the prime minister, in April, touring around Europe asking for money, not just to deal with the refugees that currently make up about a quarter of their country from Syria, but also to invest in Lebanon. And most of the time he received slammed doors on his face, like European countries saying, no, we're not going to invest in your country, and it's basically an Iranian fiefdom. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do it. And yet it looks like he found the ear of Angela Merkel of Germany, and she came out and vocally supported, as well as backing up with facts of what they've even donated last year, but vocally supported in the coming months generous donations and economic investment inside Lebanon from German companies.
So what were her statements about Lebanon?
Well, she said one sentence that was quite interesting. She probably said more in the German, but this is the particular one of interest in English. She said, there shouldn't be an impression that the international community only takes care of the refugees. We have to look at the whole of the country. So that's what we've seen up to now. Lebanon get funding to deal with the refugees from Syria. But she's saying, no, we have to look after the rest of the country. Other countries have said, well, we're not doing that because Iran's there. Well, Germany says, no, it's time to look after the whole of the country. Let's see if we can get some business deals down there to ensure that this country doesn't sink.
So what's your read on this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy? What direction do you think Lebanon will go in?
Well, from Bible prophecy, as we've talked about in this show often, from the alliance that's dictated to us really in Psalm 83, it shows that Assyria, ancient Assyrians or Germany, is going to really ally itself with certain Middle Eastern countries, and their Sunni states mainly, like Turkey, like Saudi Arabia. But in Lebanon, we have this nation that's only part Sunni. Nevertheless, the Bible says that they're going to ally with Germany, and yet we have Iran there right now. So this is an interesting step. I mean, really, if Germany's going to increase its monetary support and economic support, its investment in Lebanon, they're actually taking a page out of Iran's book. That's what Iran does in these countries a lot of the time. Hmm. Not just the terrorist proxy organizations that they build up in these states, but they also use ex-members of the IRGC or the current members of their Revolutionary Guard to set up companies inside these nations so that they have power internally through their economic might and economic power. And it looks like Germany might be going that same way in Lebanon.
Richard, you had a comment about this?
Yeah, just to point out that this has been a long-term interest of Germany as well with Lebanon, because when the United Nations interim forces in Lebanon was set up after that Hezbollah-Lebanon war, the German Navy was the bulk, overwhelmingly, of the naval task force there. And Germany, it's kind of different forces have rotated in and out there, but they've maintained a strong presence, usually off a naval base in Cyprus, along the Lebanon coast. So it does seem like they've kind of had their eye on the strategic significance of Lebanon for quite some time. And just the latest move perhaps represents an intensification of that.
Yes. Well, especially in the context of that Psalm 83 alliance, this really does look like a significant development. So we really appreciate that, Brent. For this next story, we're going to keep the discussion about Germany going. We have an article on thetrumpet.com right now by Josue Michels. It's called Right-Wing Extremism in the Bundeswehr. And to tell us about this, we'll go back to Richard.
Yes, we mentioned this in the lightning round last week, but it's one of these pieces of news that, you know, there's just been more and more coming out since then. But if you listened to last week, you may remember this story got started really with one guy that they found in the German barracks or the German army who'd been it basically looked like he'd been planning a terrorist attack. And he'd set up kind of this alter ego of a Syrian immigrant, and he planned to launch this attack and make it look like an immigrant had come to the country. Mm-hmm. He was someone who had expressed far right and neo-Nazi views for some time and on some occasions before, and the German command structure had consistently turned a blind eye. And the longer this has gone out, the longer it has looked like there's a much more entrenched problem than just an individual. And that it seems like there have been the command has generally been turning a blind eye on this for quite some time. So since then, for example, they've done a search of all the German barracks, where they found much more extremist propaganda. They had military police searching through them. They found Nazi era memorabilia, and there are about 275 cases now going on investigating racism or far-right extremism that go back over the last 6 years from the military. And about 70% of those cases have emerged in the last year and a half. So you're just seeing more of this and more of the army maybe turning – or the evidence that the army has perhaps in the past been turning a blind eye to this.
So it's far from an isolated incident, then. This is really deeply entrenched, apparently, in many rungs of the German military structure there.
That's right. And I mean, one thing that I found quite astonishing, for example, is that the German army, you had the Wehrmacht before them, that was the army in World War II, and some of the German military locations, they're staying in 1930s barracks, some of which still have the same name. Hmm. So, for example, there's one of the barracks is called the Rommel Barracks, and it's still in operation. It's still named after Erwin Rommel, and so you've got some of that has been institutionalized. But just a quote from a New York Times article talking about some of the things, some of the evidence that's been released. They wrote that one soldier attached a Nazi-era war flag to the hood of his car and drove past a refugee shelter while drawing his hand across his throat. Another posted a photo of two soldiers in SS uniform to a group chat. A handful of others are reported to have shouted, "Sieg Heil" or "Heil Hitler." These episodes are among several dozen displays of far-right extremism, xenophobia, or anti-Semitism that military officials investigating last year at the request of the Left Party, which has long insisted that far-right sympathies in the military were part of a wider societal problem. it is still very much the minority. But what is most troubling is that the command structure would be letting this pass.
Yes, in Josue's article, he mentions that the military, at least on paper, has sort of a zero tolerance policy for these kinds of incidents. But then in actual practice, they're very often giving people a second chance, such as that gentleman who you mentioned who tried to, you know, frame a terrorist attack on his false Syrian alter ego.
And one interesting point on that I thought this New York Times article made is that part of the reason why this is becoming a worsening problem, and part of the reason for that is the change in the German army. The German army used to be a conscription force, and so they didn't have a recruitment problem because you just about had to serve in it. Bit of a simplification. There was other things involved. You could do citizen service, but in general, you know, you had to serve in the army. Now it's not. Now they've got to recruit. And they think that this recruitment has led to some of this. So now they're struggling to find enough soldiers. So they've got to turn a blind eye. Otherwise, they don't want to start kicking soldiers out. It puts pressure on them to turn a blind eye. It also means that the type of person who maybe really like the Wehrmacht, or the Wehrmacht, or the SS, or the Nazis. Well, they may also be that a minority, but still the type of person that applies to join the German army. Well, someone that doesn't have those sympathies would not. And so you see a kind of an artificially high percentage of this type of individuals applying to join. And again, they're desperate for people, so they end up letting just about anybody in. Now, they're saying that they're going to change this now, that they're going to be much tighter. But it'll be interesting to see. Well, maybe then they'll have to be more forceful recruiting into the German military as part of this, more advertising, a more positive influence, a more positive picture painted of the military as a whole throughout society to try and fix this problem by persuading more people to sign up.
Yes. Yeah, well, that'll definitely be something that we would want to keep a close eye on there. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Well, a few days ago, Japan observed the 70th anniversary of the pacifist constitution that was imposed on the country after it was defeated at the end of World War II. That was 70 years ago now, back in 1947, that the pacifist constitution was put in place. And for all those years, it's become really a sort of a cherished part of Japan's post-war identity. But there have been some big steps over the past few years to amend the Constitution. And during the 70th anniversary observation, just a few days ago, Japan's leader made clear that he is more determined than ever to change it. To tell us about what happened there and what to expect going forward, we'll go to Kieran Underwood.
Japan is a really funny nation in terms of its military because, of course, technically they're not even allowed to have it. But according to a lot of rankings, they're in the top handful of strongest militaries in the world. But I think there's probably a few steps that you need to take if you want to have a military if your constitution says you can't. So first, you have to reason that you need your military for self-defense. And then second, you need to build up your self-defense forces while everyone debates whether or not it's legal. And then third and finally, I think you can just argue that the times have changed and that you need to just rewrite the Constitution and make the military legal. So Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, took that third step or tried to make that third step on May 3rd. He said he wants to make 2020 the year that a new Constitution comes into effect, which would mean he would alter the Constitution to make sure that those self-defense forces, which were, according to some of the constitutional scholars, illegal, to make those legal now. So he made some private videos and he sent them out beforehand, and then the Japanese media was allowed to publish those on May 3rd, which was the Constitution Day. But in order to make it a little more pleasing to the public and to make it more appetizing for the Japanese diet, which is their parliament, he would make sure that he wouldn't change any of the previous articles. He would only add another article in the Constitution which would allow those self-defense forces to be totally legal.
So it is sort of a subtle but still a significant step toward official remilitarization of Japan. How much of a factor do you think North Korea is in this? We know that the regime of Kim Jong-un is getting more erratic and also better armed all the time. So does that make Mr. Abe and the people of Japan more willing to let their leaders steer them back onto the path of militarism?
Well, I think it's one of those. We identified three reasons of why Abe says it's probably the most ripe opportunity to revise the constitution. One of those definitely is North Korea and China throwing their weight around in the South China Sea. But another one, and probably the reason that Shinzo Abe wants to do it as soon as possible, is that he just had his term limits extended by his party. So now he can lead the party until 2021. And then second, he has a 2/3 majority in the Japanese Diet or their parliament. So to amend the constitution, you need a 2/3 majority. He finally has a 2/3 majority now. So it's a perfect time for him to try and push something through. You also need a majority in a national referendum, but the polls are showing that it's becoming slightly more possible that it's going to happen. One of the most recent polls showed that those who were for keeping the constitution were around 46% of the respondents, and then 45% said they were willing to change it. But the ones who are changing, those polls are trending upwards, and the ones who want to keep it are trending downwards.
So he has more and more support for these changes all the time among the populace.
Yeah, and North Korea would only do him good for the changes he wants to make.
Kieran has written an article about this on thetrumpet.com. It's called "The Time is Ripe to Amend Japan's Pacifist Constitution." I encourage you to check that out. Just go to thetrumpet.com and read that there to get brought up to speed on this. Well, listeners may remember back in 2011 when Jefferson County, Alabama had to file for bankruptcy. That was a $4 billion filing, so it was a huge event. And then that was overshadowed in 2013 when Detroit filed for bankruptcy with an $18 billion filing. That one, you know, it's much larger and it sent shockwaves rippling through the whole economy, really. But now even that Detroit bankruptcy has been completely dwarfed. About a week ago, the biggest bankruptcy in the history of the American bond market, a bankruptcy of $123 billion, was triggered by Puerto Rico. And to tell us about this troubling development, we'll go once again to Andrew Miller.
Right. Now, Puerto Rico has been a country that's had definitely some financial trouble for a few years now. And finally, just on May 3rd, they finally filed for $123 billion bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And so obviously this is going to courts now where they're trying to figure out what other institutions may be able to take on parts of this debt, different banks and unions or governments. And then, of course, there's still the fact to see, is the U.S. government going to bail them out or not? So a lot of questions in the air that still in play before we know exactly how much this is going to influence financial markets in the United States. But as you mentioned before, it is the biggest bankruptcy in the U.S. bond market, even bigger than the famous Detroit bankruptcy that was tied with the auto industry clash. And of course, that was that Detroit bankruptcy happened around the same time as the subprime mortgage crisis that pushed the entire country into a recession. So it's still a little early to see what type of recessionary effects are going to come from this. But it definitely is a really real threat. And it definitely highlights just the seriousness of where spending behind your means will get you eventually. We have an article on the front page of the Trumpet right now by the Trumpet's financial analyst, Rob Morley, just pointing out how even 10 years ago, Puerto Rico was considered kind of like a socialist Caribbean paradise, as you had living beyond their means. But I mean, eventually you do that for long enough, you run out of other people's money to spend and it collapses down on you. And Puerto Rico is even a little more, sees a little more immediate effects because it is a United States territory, not one of the 50 states. And so there have been a number of people who've kind of compared it to like America's Greece, that they're now applying for bailouts to where sometimes like some states like New Mexico, Mississippi, West Virginia have financial problems similar to Puerto Rico's, but because they're part of the United States Transfer Union, you get bailouts kind of come to them a little more automatically, and you don't necessarily hear about it. It just kind of gets either taken care of by surpluses coming from Texas or California or other states, or it just gets thrown on the tab of the national debt, which is basically just like kicking that can down the road.
So you think the situation with Puerto Rico will be different, though, since it's not a state?
Since it's not a state, some of the bailout functions aren't as automatically. It's more something that you do need a bunch of like legal rigmarole that you're going through right now to see, okay, is the United States going to bail them out? Because they don't necessarily have to. And if they don't, are they going to be able to get other financial institutions be able to like privatize some of that debt? Mm-hmm. Or if that doesn't happen, is it just going to let the jolt the bond market and possibly push the country into recession?
So how should the typical American expect this to affect them?
Right. Well, obviously the typical American citizen who doesn't live in Puerto Rico is basically your major concern is going to see is like, okay, is if America chooses to bail them out, it's just going to contribute more to the national debt and a possible economic crisis later. Hmm. If America doesn't bail them out, then you could be seeing a similar threat of recession like there was in 2009.
Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories that we're discussing today. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from our panelists coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last brief look at some of the other big headlines from this week that caught our attention. First, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Being an official member of the Communist Party may no longer be a fireable offense in California government. Under a bill passed Monday by the California State Assembly, all references to Communist Party officials were deleted as empty labels. Instead, the assemblyman who sponsored the bill said it should focus more on people's individual actions than what party they're a member of. He calls this bill a cleanup bill that removes archaic language. And if it passes the Senate, it would open the way for Communist Party officials to openly serve in California instead of having to quit the Communist Party and join some other party of their choice before they run.
Hmm. Okay, and Brent.
Hamas's political bureau chief Khaled Mashal announced last week that Ismail Haniyeh has been chosen as his successor as the head of the Hamas movement. Haniyeh's announcement comes just 2 months after Yahya Sinwar, a brutal terrorist, was made the head of the Gaza Strip, the territory that Hamas controls. So basically, Haniyeh is going to be Sinwar's new boss. Now, this is not a turn towards moderation. Haniyeh has praised the killing of Israeli civilians in the past through terror attacks. He's pledged to continue violent opposition to Israel until it is fully liberated. What's interesting, though, is Haniyeh enjoys widespread support among Palestinians, both in Gaza and in the West Bank. In fact, polls taken in recent years show that if elections took place between Haniyeh, he would actually defeat Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who comes from the rival Fatah movement.
Kieran.
This summer and next summer, Russian activists will need to get permission from the Federal Security Service to stage any mass protests. This Wednesday, Vladimir Putin issued an executive decree which introduced new restrictions on all public events unrelated to sports in the regions across Russia, which will host the 2017 FIFA Confederations Cup and the 2018 FIFA World Cup. So if you want to demonstrate there, you need to get permission first.
Okay, now we'll go to Richard.
The manifesto of Britain's Labour Party was leaked this week. This is the set of promises that they promised to stand behind in the election. And it reveals them as basically out-and-out communists. Not that that was a big secret. They want to nationalize energy, nationalize the railways, nationalize the mail service, hike spending up to one of some of its highest levels since World War II, a massive increase in the government doing everything. I just think it's really astonishing that such a far left party is the number two party in Britain.
And now we'll go once again to Brent.
The UN's humanitarian advisor for Syria, Jan Egeland, said yesterday that he's held talks with Iran, Russia, and Turkey about their deal to establish four de-escalation zones inside Syria. Those talks focused on determining which parties should control and monitor the safe zones. It's come down to these three nations that look like they are going to be the ones that monitor it rather than a UN group. However, Israel is very concerned that this is going to mean that Iran will be there with its own troops monitoring this safe zone program on the Golan Heights just across the border from Israel.
Okay, and Andrew.
Canada's Postal Service is releasing a homosexual marriage stamp as part of Canada's 150th anniversary celebrations. The stamp is in the shape of a maple leaf with a rainbow flag and marks the 2005 Civil Marriage Act passed under Liberal Prime Minister Paul Martin. The stamp is a fourth of a series of 10 that supposedly commemorates key events in Canada's history since 1867.
Okay, and now for our final story, we'll go back to Richard.
Bit of breaking news here. Britain's National Health Service appears to be under cyber attack right now. There's some kind of ransomware is shut down. A whole load of their services. It's still ongoing, but there's a massive amount of potentially confidential data at risk here, and another illustration of just the potential that comes from cyber attacks.
Thanks for that, Richard. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our print edition and our Trumpet Brief. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Kieran Underwood, and Brent Noctegal.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you today with some words about education from the American writer Howard Gardner. He said, "If you think education is expensive, try estimating the cost of ignorance." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a real pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.